this podcast powered by Telcaster.com.
Welcome to Martial Secrets, where we seek out the most interesting and skilled martial artists to share their insights and years of training with you, the listener. I'm your host, Chris Wilder, and on this broadcast, Sergeant Rory Miller. Sergeant Rory Miller is a sergeant with an undisclosed county in Oregon with the Sheriff's Department. He holds a teaching certificate in Soshu Shitsuru Jiu-Jitsu. That certificate is called a Mokoruku. He has studied jiu-jitsu for some 23 years. He's the leader of the emergency response team for a corrections facility. He's a specialist in defensive tactics and hand-to-hand combat. He's also trained in fencing and judo. Welcome, Sergeant Miller.
Morning, Chris.
Good morning. We're saying undisclosed county so that what we're able to do is talk freely and not have to run anything that you say past your superior, correct?
Yeah, our policy states that anything, whenever I'm representing the agency, I have to run everything through there. Without knowing what the questions are, that would be impossible.
Right, and we want to keep this a little bit open and have an opportunity to, cover some things that may not necessarily any department would want to have out there. It's just we're going to remove the bureaucracy and we're going to have a little bit of fun. Let's take a second. Let's talk about jail and jiu-jitsu. Let's talk about the two J's.
Okay.
You're there. You're in contact with these folks that are various levels of criminality. Has the jiu-jitsu been the ticket, or would you have much preferred to have been involved in Kenpo or judo or taekwondo? I mean, how is it working for you, and why does it work for you, if it does?
It's complicated. Question in a way, things have changed a lot in the last, I started in corrections almost 15 years ago, and in the old days, it was a much more hands-on, fur-flying, wild times. It's gone from a point where my personal record for uses of force is 8 in 1 night, and averaging 2 a week work in reception, to they become more and more rare as our culture has changed. There are fewer things. We're able to talk them down more. So that's part of the question.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that we have to separate between two completely different kinds of force. When someone's being marginally non-cooperative and they need to get cuffs on, they need to go to a cell, that's one thing. And for that, the heavy emphasis, wrist locks and some close contact wrestling type stuff, you know, judo, aikido works great. Aspects of jiu-jitsu work great. The thing that jiu-jitsu really shines in is the ambushes. When someone's decided they're going to take out an officer and you happen to be the one in the room, you're outnumbered. Going back to something that was designed for a situation very much like that, for a very bad day on a medieval battlefield where you lost your sword, works really well.
As you walked into that as a traditional martial artist, and let's say anybody is, taking some traditional martial artist attitude with them. Let's say that they're, a shodan, an entry-level black belt, and they walk into your job, into your business. What can they expect from the jail environment, and how does that, what happens when those two worlds collide?
It depends entirely on the training and on you. When you walk in, you're going to be dealing with what you see. And if your training's filtered you to see things only in a certain way, then you're going to get blindsided. When stuff really happens, it's chaotic. It's different. The difference between someone who's been in, 100 jail fights and, has a shank or knows how to use a shank, and is setting up an ambush, and a drunk idiot who doesn't want to be touched and doesn't want you searching him and taking his stuff and putting it in a plastic bag is different. And very few martial arts prepare for both of those. So that's the biggest thing, is if you walk in thinking you already know it, you're at a disadvantage, no matter how well you do know it.
How many altercations have you had? I assume that any altercation over the course of your 15 years has to be documented, for the records and
they're documented.
All of that.
I have to write a report. The Internal Affairs
Unit. And anybody has to write a report on any kind of altercation.
Anyone that's
correct?
Involved, plus anyone that sees it under our new policy.
Okay. Anyone that
sees or hears anything. And let's see. And the Internal Affairs Unit keeps them on file for 3 years. And let's see. I quit counting at 300.
Okay. 300 is a good number.
I mean, I honestly have no idea.
Okay. Before we go too far, talking about altercations and, in excess of 300 documented altercations, very bluntly, mm-hmm. I and the listeners, we want to hear a war story. So you're going to have to tell a war story now and be prepared because I'm going to ask you one for later on in the show. So
okay.
Right now, let's hear about one of the most violent encounters you've been involved in. And most importantly, what did you take away from it?
Okay, let's see. Probably the one that in all time went worst was entirely due to a mental error. And it wasn't at work. It was on the way home from work. I was still a rookie. I was still on probation. And bus dropped me off, walking distance from home. I'm walking down, and two guys step out. And it's, from what I know now, it's a classic interview. It was the, hey, where you going? How you doing? And they were getting too close. They were triangulating out. They were cornering me against the fence. There were two of them. They were brothers. They were both larger than I was. And the littler one, reached for me. And I just parried his hand away, and I smiled, and I said, I have time right now, guys. I'm on my way home. And he said, don't fucking touch me. And he stepped back, and his big brother took a swing. And it wasn't a big deal. I've been hit before. I ducked, so it carted on the corner of my skull. It did far more damage to his hand than it did to me. And then right then, the first thought that ran across my mind is I'm still on probation. I have a baby on the way. If I hurt either of these guys, I will lose this job. And for the next 15 minutes, I tried to fight them without hurting them. On a two-on-one, they got the first move, and both bigger than I was. The first dumb thing that I did was he went to swing again. And just to prove I was faster than he was, I kicked him in the chest before he could get his fist on me. I wanted him to see that I could kick faster than he could punch. That's what I thought I was teaching him. What he took away from that was I wasn't going to hurt him. By the end of the encounter, they asked to take breathers twice.
They actually said,
yeah.
We got to take a breath.
I'm pinned up against a fence, so, I'm not going anywhere. I had a gun in my shoulder bag, which I didn't have time to get out. At one point, one of them grabbed the bag and swung it at me, and I stepped in a hip through him. Probably the worst, though, was I came up with this great plan to, big guy was going to swing again. I knew he was going to swing. I was going to take him down in a sumagaishi, which is a judo throw. You grab the guy, you roll onto your back, and you use your legs on the inside of his legs to flip him. I knew I could take him down. I knew I could get him in an arm lock, the one that's really popular in Brazilian jiu-jitsu between the legs, jiu-jitsu-katami. Mm. And I tell the other one to back off or I'd break his arm. Sumagaishi didn't go that well. He wound up on top. He went to gouge my eyes. I wrapped over and locked him up and took him down, protecting my eyes. I put him in the arm lock just like I planned. I started to say, back off or I will, and I got kicked in the head 3 times. Okay, and the time it takes to make that statement, you can get kicked in the head at least 3 times. So, let's see. So I learned a lot about timing, learned a lot about grappling with multiple opponents, but most importantly, I learned that if you let something drift into your head, like I have to do this a certain way or I can't do this, you'll cripple yourself. You have to do what you have to do. This thing lasted long enough for the cops to show up.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you how that ended.
That's how it ended. Is there at one point, you know, on the ground with one of them sitting down, breathing heavy. I just got my bag back from the other guy that I threw. This has gone on now for not only 15 minutes, but almost a block. And the cops roll up. Like, I'm so happy. But I felt like a complete idiot because at each time I was faster than they were. I was in better shape. I knew what to do. At each time during the encounter, I'd knocked them both down. I'd had them. And I had, because of a really, really stupid decision, that I'll lose my job if I hurt either of these guys. When, you know, 15 years later, as a use of force instructor, you know, I would have been fully justified in shooting them.
Tell me about the interview process. What does that entail? And let's use this instance to demonstrate what is the interview process. Is this their means of determining whether you're a mark?
I'm going to back it up two ways, because there are two basic kinds of predators. And a predator is one of several different types of criminals. Predator wants something, whether it's, you know, your money, drugs, rape, or even just establishing his reputation. So he's going to pick a mark. A blitz predator will pick the mark, and then we'll ambush him. He's using a lot of body language. These guys, the ones who use the interview, are trying to use verbals to get close enough that first strike comes in faster than you can stop it. If it comes in close enough, it's... Blocking is one of the big myths in martial arts. Almost every martial art, they practice that, like, extra half step away. That's where you bow in. That's where you start. That's what gives blocks time to work. If you're actually standing, you know, chest to chest or close enough that your elbow can touch the guy on the shoulder, you will almost never be able to block a punch when it comes in. So part of the interview stance, or part of the interview concept, is to get that close. And there's some aspect of seeing whether or not you're going to be a mark, whether you're going to fight, and I was too polite. And that's one of the things, that they didn't think that there was going to be a serious fight.
I see. So what you were engaged in then was a simple disengagement. I'm not interested because I don't think I want to, you know, they interpret it as this guy doesn't want to roll with us, so he doesn't believe his own physical ability or something along that line.
I was trying to de-escalate something they'd already decided would happen. They already had the numbers. They had the distance, they had the advantage in size, and they pretty much already decided it was going to happen. At that point, the interview was just to get close enough to make it quick.
Now, that's a very interesting thing that you say there, and I want to go back and kind of verbally underline that. What you're saying is that it had already been determined, the assessment had already been made when they saw you coming down the street. The interview process was only for them to get within striking distance. Is that
right?
Correct?
Yeah, they'd see me. They were walking down the street. They knew I was tired. I put in a long day. I was carrying a bag. And I was kind of happy. This was the whole just bought my first house, going home, madly in love with my wife, baby on the way. It was one of those, you know, very happy Kodak moments. Perfect.
Kodak moment.
Yeah.
How do correction officers see the jail? Are there categories? I mean, when somebody comes in, are you making an assessment and putting them in a category, and then within that category there are assumed responses?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Okay. There are different kinds of jails.
I want to point out something, too. I think this is really interesting because this is actually a reverse interview of the one that just happened. Am I correct?
Yeah, you can look at it that way, yeah.
Okay.
Our jails are direct supervision, which means that the officer is locked in a room with the bad guys. It's not like the old jails where they were in cells and you walk the catwalk behind the cells. You're actually in there with them. And it's, you know, 8 hours a day, or you get a lunch break, so, you know, 7 or 6.5 hours a day of direct interaction with criminals. You get really, really good at reading people really, really fast. And most of the experienced officers, and we do have a handful that will never get it, but most of the experienced officers are very, very good at reading people. and also very, very good at calming them down. We would, what normally comes in is a person comes into jail. They've been arrested. They are not having their best day. A large number of them have drugs on board. Drugs change your judgment. They make you do things that normally you would never be stupid enough to do.
When you say on board, you mean ingested. On drugs. Okay.
Yeah, drugs on board, yeah. They're high on something. And it ranges from, alcohol, marijuana, all the way on up to PCP. And fairly often, the arrest process did not go the way they wanted, and they're looking for some payback. One of the big changes in our culture is that up until 5 years ago, the arresting officers would come in and would throw them in a chute, a sally port, a little tiny room with a door on the officer side, which was the outside of the jail, and a door on our side, which was the inside. The arresting officers knew they'd have no contact with this guy, so they would say anything they wanted and basically get him in a frenzy, knowing that we would deal with it when he came out.
And here's your hot potato.
Right, and it's one of those, he wouldn't have any contact with him, so he could say what he's really thinking. And some of these officers had just seen horrific crime scenes,
Sure.
Dump this guy and then find the crying baby in the back room. And they were upset, and they would let it show. So we'd get the guys, and they were still hot, or wanted some payback, or wanted to get some kind of vengeance. And we had an excellent record for both talking them down, or if that failed, putting them down without hurting them. And that's can be challenging, but that's a job.
So let's say you're looking at somebody who had a bad night, maybe lost their job, found out that their girlfriend was stepping out on them. They went over to the local tavern, got tanked up, got aggressive, wind up in there. That's going to be a much different category than somebody who's been cooking methamphetamine for the last 3 months.
In a way, they're a different category, but the one that got tanked up and feels his life is terrible is the one that's most likely to fight. The guy that's been cooking meth, in almost every case, has been to jail many, many times before. He knows he's going to lose. He knows half of us by name. And he can walk in, and we can say, are we going to have any trouble? And he'll say, hell no, I'm not stupid.
Ah.
And he'll do it. Probably the ones that both fight most and you feel the worst about are the ones that feel they're normal citizens who haven't done anything wrong or anything very wrong and don't know why they're being treated like this. One of the most horrible, there's this 80-year-old woman who was arrested for drunk driving. She had a foreign accent, and she is shrieking that she survived Nazi Germany, and they didn't send little old ladies to jail for having a little drink.
Good grief.
And she was okay, and I'm kind of calming her down, and we had a protester, some, hemp-wearing, not horribly clean, on the other side, trying to get this old lady to fight us, yelling, don't take it from him. Don't take it from him, Grandma. Fight those bastards.
Now that is a scene. Well, because nobody's going to win in this.
No, and it's like, if she swings, I'm going to have to put her back in cuffs and these frail little tiny bones. So I had to tell the protester what she was doing. She was angling to get a little old lady hurt, and I hope she felt good about that, and she shut up.
Wow.
But those are the ones they fight more often because they think they can win because they haven't been in fights before. And B, they honestly feel righteous.
I've read some of your writings, and you talk about the monkey dance. Mm-hmm. Explain to the listeners that have not heard of this, what is the monkey dance? How do you define that?
Every mammal species and most reptiles and even fish have an intraspecies dominance display that they go through. It's designed to be non-lethal. The usual example I use is everyone has seen the grizzlies on National Geographic. They face off, they growl, they go, R, R, R. they stand up, they nibble at each other, they smack each other, and then one of them wanders away and the other one keeps the territory. Okay, they never, this is an animal that can take apart a car, they can break an elk's neck by swiping its paws once, but they never really get injured. Same thing with bighorn sheep. If the sheep, you know, the one place they're designed to hit each other is when they hit each other. They never sneak around and nail each other from the side and take
the herd. Right, the headbutting that you see on the side of the mountain.
Right. Humans have the same ritual combat that's designed not to hurt anybody. And it follows these steps. And you've heard the steps from me before. So you get that, you know, that hard eye contact. One guy's, you know, might just be gazing off, and the other guy thinks he's staring at him, starts staring back and staring and glaring. And then he'll say something. It's usually challenging. You know, what are you staring at? But there's a verbal challenge. And sometimes when they start to face off, they actually start to see the chest pump up and down, and it looks just like a prairie hen mating dance.
It's a prairie hen mating dance.
You ever watch that?
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying, but it makes it ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, but it's biologically determined, and that's one of the weirdest things is if someone challenges you on this, you will have a tendency to challenge back. You'll have a tendency to get into it, and once you start playing the game, you're stuck. This is very, in my opinion, this is very biological. But they'll get there. They'll get to touching distance. Sometimes the verbals will continue. And usually at this point, it ends. Someone apologizes or whoever thinks that they're going to lose. But if it doesn't end, the next couple steps is one of them will either push on the chest or do the pointy finger thing in the chest. If they do the pointy finger thing on the nose, it's on. That will always go physical. Think about it. That goes into humans touch another human's face. Big taboo.
Either a sign of dominance or
great intimacy, yeah.
Right.
So if I'm facing off with you and you're pissed and I poke my finger on your nose.
That's the magic button.
You're going.
I'm amazed at the simplicity of it, and I am also somewhat chagrined at never having recognized that.
Does any animal recognize what it's doing? It can see what other animals are doing. But anyway, and then after that touch, if it goes physical, because some people will back off there, it'll be a big looping punch. And my feeling was it was a dominant hand punch, but Mac, who's one of the guys that does what I do, he says he's been watching even left-handers do a right-hand punch since we started watching this. I don't have enough data to back that up, but if even left-handers do a right-hand punch on this, then it's definitely biological.
Hmm. Tell me this. How does adrenaline change the world?
It makes it smaller. That was flippant, I'm sorry.
No, it's not flippant at all. That's an interesting perspective.
There's so much stuff going on, and it depends on how adrenalized you get. I think the thing that most people don't recognize is how different their brains are when things are about to go really, really bad. They get, you know, you're kind of where you got the sweaty palms, and your knees are shaking, you got butterflies. You know that feeling, right?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Okay, so let's see. Let's go back to college. Did you ever get that feeling when you were thinking about asking a girl out?
Are you kidding? I still do today.
Okay.
Not much has changed.
So as kind of an illustration, when you get that feeling, how good are you at talking to girls?
You are a babbling gel of idiocy.
Okay, the exact same thing happens to your fighting skills when you get it with a combatant.
Very interesting.
That's
an interesting view.
It's the same mechanism. You get this dump of hormones, and I know you. You're a good talker. You can talk to anybody, unless you want to really, really bad. And it's kind of the same thing. We can get really specific. You do get tunnel vision, which means that you aren't going to see anything coming from the sides. You're going to be looking at one thing. One of the most dangerous things is an adrenaline-based behavioral loop, where you keep doing the same thing over and over again, even though it's not working. And that's, we get that with rookies that, like, they learned one good technique at the academy, and they're going to make this wrist lock work, and they're getting the crap pounded out of them, but they can't think to, you know, I need to do something else. There's video available from lineofduty.com of Deputy Kyle Dinkeller getting murdered. And at one point, he is yelling, put the weapon down, 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 put the weapon down. And he can't break that loop until he is shot. After he's shot, then suddenly his body realizes, oh, wait, that wasn't working like we thought it was. And he starts shooting back, but it's too late.
Yeah, I have, I've seen that video. And, you know, I don't care how much somebody can sit, you know, somebody can sit there and armchair quarterback it, mm-hmm. but, you know, you're not experiencing that adrenaline loop that this guy is in. And when you watch the other guy go back and start loading a rifle in full view mm-hmm. in his truck, and yeah. and the officer continues with that same loop over and over, and you realize that this is real. I saw that in a group of about, I think probably about 40, 45 people, and I don't think anybody was breathing during that entire time because it was real. It was a man being shot to death, and it was this stark panic that froze everybody in their seats, realizing what was happening and realizing that it very well could happen to them, that adrenal loop. And I rarely have been involved in such a powerful moment, and that was, and it was very real. It was real. It was it.
It was from his dashboard camera. It was his death, right there. And you know, thankfully, you didn't see it, but you heard him.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this: Can you train your reaction, or are you just a victim of your body at a certain point?
It's not a victim. All of these things are good on a biological level, but they were designed for being eaten by an animal. If you are being chewed on by a lion, or let's use bears because we're in North America, okay, the spinning kick of doom is not going to help you. The best finger lock in the world is not going to help you. But maybe just banging on its nose might, again and again and again and again and again and again and again, like you aren't going to stop. Might discourage it. All the blood pools to your center, so it could chew on your arms and legs and you won't bleed to death. That might save you. What that happens to martial artists is that means that suddenly your fingers don't work really well, so all those nifty grabs and finger locks you've got are gone. You can't coordinate your arms and your legs together. They call that complex motor skills. So your trapping, your combinations, anything that requires moving your arms and legs at the same time doesn't work right. And at the highest level, if you get completely blacked out, you're going to go limp, freeze, and your bowels and bladder are going to let loose. Okay, can you imagine that helping you in a fight?
That's like a skunk. That's the skunk defense.
Right, and for a predator knows what dead is. That's awful close to dead. And there have been times when bears have buried people that were still alive thinking they were dead, and the people survived. So it's a semi-functional for the environment it was designed in. You know, it wasn't a good chance, but it was a chance.
Sure.
The thing is that we're trying to use a sophisticated thing to fight people when our bodies are wired for when you get that scared, sophisticated crap doesn't work. That's hard to get past.
Rory, we're at our time already. I'd like to go over. Can you stay with us for a little longer?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, you got me on my day off.
Okay, fantastic. Well, let me ask you this question then. Is there a gender difference in the way adrenaline is experienced?
Very much.
Because it's adrenaline and there is a difference. Tell us about that.
Guys have a big spike early and it tapers off quick. Women tend to have a very, very slow buildup and it doesn't get as high a peak and it's a longer taper off. The person that clued me into this was Toby Beck, and she wrote a wonderful book called The Armored Rose about training women to fight. What she was curious about was that in a home invasion shooting, if the homeowner shot the crook. If it was a guy, it would be two shots at the door. And if it was a woman, she would retreat and retreat and retreat and retreat and retreat and retreat and retreat, and then empty the magazine. And she started looking at that.
So what you're saying is that you're finding, excuse me, in theory here, what you're finding is you're finding a burglar dead in a woman's bedroom with an empty magazine on top of it.
Or in the last room in the
okay.
basement.
Sure.
So she started looking at that, and, you know, there's that, and she's the one that came up with this, and we've used this before, but that classic experiment, and every married person will recognize this. From the guy's point of view, you get an argument with your wife, and you're getting pissed. And finally you just, damn it, and you just stomp out. You leave, you slam the door, you go for a walk. You come back 5-10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, you're going, all right, she was right. I'm sorry, I'm just going to apologize now, get it over with. And you come in the door and you walk into this shitstorm of fury. And she'd been pretty calm when you left. And that's all that was happening, was it took her that long for her adrenaline to build up. So by your timing, you're walking into the worst possible time you could be when you just calmed down.
Have you had an opportunity to talk to Dr. Phil about this?
No. No. Phil, me, and Oprah don't get along.
Okay. Rory, we hear stories about people doing things beyond their physical abilities. You know, we've all heard these things, kind of urban myths, you know, the little lady lifting the car off mm-hmm. of the family, these kinds of things. But we've also heard the stories of like, cops being shot in the leg and dying, and the criminal being hit 23 times and still jumping a fence. You know, are those urban myths? Are they real?
Let's see. God, I want to answer that both ways. Stuff like that happens. I have a concern that people either count on it or expect it, that they'll either say there's no point in training because it won't work against, you know, one of these guys, or they'll turn out and go, well, my special magical power will kick in if I ever need it to, so I don't need to train. So, but as far as this stuff going, because I know you want another horror story.
Well, that's coming a little bit. Don't get too far ahead of me, but if you've got a good one, do throw it in.
Well, I've got one. Some of them are let's see, I want to say personal. We've had in custody, I was not involved in this one, one guy who fought off, and he was a small guy, and he fought off 8 officers for about 45 minutes.
Now, and again, this is documented. It is in the file.
Yeah, well, this one went to a federal court case and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, okay.
Because what had happened, there's this state called excited delirium, and it's usually involved with drugs, and sometimes not, sometimes it's mental. And some of the signs are, you know, the person's temperature goes way, way up. They've had liver temperatures 108 degrees after death. And this is at the autopsy after death. So God knows what it was.
108, isn't 108?
You start dying at 106. 106 is brain damage. And these guys are at 108. So they tend to strip down. They break glass. Their brains are completely out of whack. And they will fight beyond what a human being should be able to fight. It's one of those things where there's some controversy about whether the diagnosis exists, but that controversy is only kept alive by defense attorneys. It's been far documented far too well what it's like to fight these guys. But since most people never see one, it's not an issue. Anyway, this guy fought off 8 officers, and it wasn't, you know, a boxing match. It was wrestling. He had, at different times, 8 officers on him and was lifting them all off the ground and throwing them out of the room. And then suddenly he just calmed down, and they put cuffs on him, and he rolled over and died. He had literally ruptured his own heart from fighting that long.
That is absolutely amazing.
I've been involved with people like that a couple times, but, you know, whether I've been luckier or not, it hasn't gone that bad. It's a... You and I have talked about physiological joint locks versus pain joint locks.
Yeah, correct, yeah.
And I've taken them out of control with the ground. There's The first PCP guy I ever had to do a cell extraction on, I was expecting the super strength, and I wasn't too concerned about that because I had a system. What I wasn't expecting was the speed. The guy was doing, you know, come on, let's all die together. He's starting to hurt himself, so we had to go in. And my normal system for this is I have
something else. Let me ask you something here, Rory.
Yeah.
At this point, when he's saying, come on in, let's all die together, and he's hurting himself, he's using the injury of himself as a technique to pull you in because he intends to take you with?
Right. I'll be legally liable if I let him hurt himself.
Okay.
And so we can't, so we have to go in. And this is
and they know this.
Right. And this is, well, he was too far gone to know it.
Oh, okay.
He literally just, he wanted to die and he wanted to kill some people.
Okay.
I actually at this time thought he was pretty much insane. I mean, I assumed he had probably something on board, but I wasn't too worried about it. But what I normally do is I have someone else key the door open, so I'm talking to him. And my team has really, you know, specific instructions. It wasn't really, we didn't have the CERT team at the time. This was the normal guys I worked with in booking.
CERT is on an acronym.
The Corrections Emergency Response Team. That's our tactical team.
Okay. All right. This is plastic shields, helmets, boots, whole thing, right?
Right.
Okay.
This incident was before we had Bill. Yeah, before we started. So that's my team. Anyway, so I have someone else key the door while I'm talking, and they've got instructions that they clip the lock while he's talking, swing the door open, I enter. I use a drop step for speed, get one hand on the elbow so it turns them. There's a bench right there. It turns their knees into the bench, which is a physiological lockout, and I can take them down through leverage. And I'm on their back, and I can control all their leverage points, and they don't, even if they have the strength to lift a car, they don't have the leverage to do it. It's worked really well for me. He heard the key in the door, and he was ready when I went in. So I still stepped in, did the spin, and then at the point, and this was, you know, a fast spin with his feet, with his legs, you know, a couple of inches from the concrete bench, and he just floated. He jumped up on top of the bench, and there was no way I was going to let this guy get enough space to hit me. So I followed it and jumped up with him and stayed as close as I could. At that point, I leveraged his shoulders back in and swept, and you've done a good Akuriyashi Rai, right, where you sweep both legs and they wind up about shoulder height?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I got one of those. And just for 1 second, time kind of freezes, and he's starting to lever down. His head's going head first into the concrete. I'm thinking, you know.
Oh, good grief.
And I imagine the whole headline. You know, martial artist corrections officer kills mentally ill man.
In white hot rage.
Yeah, yeah, because it definitely would have been my fault.
Yeah.
And all this had happened before my backup had been able to get through the door. This happened everything under a second.
Yeah, I was going to say probably about a full second.
Yeah. And they caught him in midair.
Good grief.
They caught him in midair. We got cuffs on. We got him on a restraint board, which is basically a spine board, only with chains. And he was fine.
Now, this restraint board, that's pretty much what we see skiers being brought off the hill.
Right, only with handcuffs and ankle irons on it.
Okay.
And more straps so that you can't get any leverage with your knees or elbows.
So let me ask you a question about that. You know, as we touched on adrenaline earlier, did you have the adrenal dump prior, during, or after?
I'm a special case. Because one of the things you'll find is that adrenal dump, about your 50th or 60th time, it just doesn't spike like that anymore.
So you have to find your thrills elsewhere, huh?
Well, there's that. Because that's a definite aspect to it. There was one point where I was so burned out, I couldn't get an adrenaline rush. I had, in order to get mildly interested, I had to have people shoot at me. And that's really, really not right or healthy or safe. That's a longer story I can't go into right now. But what that does is that allows me to use some of the complex stuff and the fine motor skills that other people can't access, which is one of the reasons I get to do this so much. They call me if it's going to go bad.
Understood. Going back to your writings, I see you use, you know, we talked about, you know, some of the other stuff. We talked about the monkey dance. But What about the rhinoceros and the unicorn? What's that about? Can you explain it to our listeners?
It's a work in progress, which, by the way, I think I finally got it formatted and readable. So the first draft is done as of last night.
Oh,
so
well.
I'll be contacting a little bit to take a look at it. What it's about is that people can train in martial arts for their whole lives. And they get this idea of what violence is from martial arts. And fairly often that has no relation whatsoever to what violence is. Even people that go into the reality-based self-defense sometimes bring some really, really weird or inappropriate experiences in and try to stretch them to what's going on. The core concept I use, I call it the matrix. But if you think about what violence can be, there's self-defense. You know, you don't know what's happening. Something breaks over the back of the head. You don't know what's going on or why or who or how many. That's one situation. There's also sparring, where you've got months to train. You know who your opponent is. You know what the rules are. And you're going to go in. You've got time to psych up beforehand. There's assault training, which is what SWAT teams do. We train to go in and take the guy down. And for us, the big thing is practice and planning. And then just ruthless dedication, shock and awe. A soldier has to follow orders. That's more important than any of his individual skills, is that his superiors can rely on him doing exactly what they expect, because that's the level the mission is won at. And we can go on, you know, fitness and spiritual growth and all the things that martial artists think that they're doing are incompatible. The mindset that I need to be when I'm going to do an entry and I'm going to take down a crook as efficiently as possible is totally different than what I need when I suddenly realize I'm in the middle of an ambush. They aren't related in any way, and you can't train for both at the same time.
Now that is that takes me aback, because that is not what you hear across, you know, dojo, dojang, quan, wherever you train, gymnasium. You know, when you train, oftentimes your instructor is saying, this is going to do this for you. And there's this hodgepodge of training for different kinds of situations. But what you're saying is that they're mutually exclusive. If they're, say, the difference between premeditated, I'm going to take this action, to a blitzkrieg attack.
Right. Think about the most, not formal, but militant class you've ever seen, with people, you know, yelling, yes, sir, whenever the instructor says anything, and doing exactly what he says, never thinking about it. Is that person, the student in that class, going to be more vulnerable to a crook that tries to intimidate with voice commands?
Absolutely.
And if that's true, then you're setting them up to be more likely to be rape victims, because that's the most common way that our rapists get their victims, is through verbal intimidation.
Absolutely fascinating.
So, yeah, I mean, you just have to, you have to think that through all the time. You have to understand what you're training for and what you want to train for. And for the most people, we have this image that this is this violent, horrible time. But if you actually look at the statistics, violent crime is like at the lowest rate since we've been accurately recording it. It's been dropping steadily. And when people go back to the 70s or the 50s reaching for this time, the real issue is that we weren't counting it back then.
Well, you know,
child abuse
Grossman
wasn't even a crime back then.
Sure. I mean, looking at Grossman's book on killing,
yeah.
You know, he's showing some numbers that seem to indicate that.
Well, and that's one of the things. If you go directly to a source, don't take his word for it. Don't take my word for it. Go to the FBI's UCR, and I think it's FBI.gov, and look for the UCR, the Uniform Crime Reports, and the statistics are right there. And they show a drop.
Is it because it's an aging society? You know, a lack of tribalism now? You know, I'm asking you right now, what's the main reason, the magic reason that we're seeing that drop?
If I had to make a guess, and you were really pushing me, and this would be easier, biggest guess is when I was going to my kid's school, in their first and second grade, they had no private property or private space. Their desks weren't their desks. The stuff in their desk wasn't their stuff. They would get all their school supplies that they were required to bring in, and they would go into big pool for everybody. And there's been this cultural shift away from any kind of personalization. And if you think about how much of the violence has always been based, and I'm very ambivalent about this, but how much of the violence has always been based on, you know, my stuff, my identity, my territory. And if we're getting these kids at, you know, 6, 7 years old that are actually discouraged from having an identity to defend, the violence will go down.
If you'd asked the question of me, and of course I had some time to think about this because I prepared the questions beforehand, I would have simply said reliable food source.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been my answer, but I absolutely have to say that your comment is definitely some grist for the mill. That's something that needs to be thought about, and I'm going to be observing my son's school quite severely in the next week or so to kind of see if that's in turn starting to manifest itself there. Rory, have you ever been injured in any of these tussles? And you know, the next question is, how badly?
I get hurt way worse in training than I've ever been hurt in real life. And I want to say I don't know why, but it's basically I don't take chances if I could avoid it. The one I told you about was probably the worst looking damage I've ever taken. 3 kicks in the head make your face look less pretty. And I was mildly concussed, but that was it.
Again, there would be an opportunity for me, having seen you and know you, to comment that the damage and change was negligible.
Oh, no. I've had my nose broken like twice now, and it just keeps getting straighter.
Oh, well, so, very good.
But I very rarely get hurt at work. I'm trying to come up with some dramatic injury that I've had that wasn't in training.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's like I've been in fights in barracks in San Antonio. I got shoulder dislocated in that. I just popped it back in and kept fighting. And that's one of the things. You know, we have this thing, you know, if you get in a knife fight, you will get cut. But I've been in 5 now, or 5 encounters, and I haven't been scratched. But a lot of that is just either not letting it happen or overwhelming force.
Okay.
You get hurt when you try to turn it into a game.
Sure. You recently were on the east coast of the States to work with a traditional group of martial artists, a bunch of karateka.
Yeah.
How does a west coast jiu-jitsu instructor wind up 3,000 miles from home with a bunch of traditional karate folks? I mean, tell me how that works.
Okay. There's, let's see, I got introduced to the internet about 5 years ago. And there are 3 forums that I sometimes hang out on. Budoseek is run by a good jiu-jitsu guy, and I really like it, and there are a lot of kids there, but I like about a handful of the people. And there's very high percentage of cops, so we can talk about stuff. Then there's CyberKun. I know absolutely nothing about Chinese martial arts. So that's where I started going just to
what was
find
that
out some
cyber
stuff.
What?
CyberKun. KWOON.
Okay.
And those were about the first people that I actually went to meet, because I wanted to meet a French guy who was teaching Chinese martial arts in Tokyo. And they were a blast. They were a blast and very knowledgeable, and I had a good time. But the one that I put out some of the most personal stuff and where I'm trying to think ideas out was wechi-ryu.com. And these are guys, they're one system, and a lot of them cross-train, but they're very passionate, love it a lot, and it's like this big squabbling family. Everyone's arguing about what's the best and what to do, and they're arguing modern training methods and ancient Chinese methods, and they're just having a great time. But it's the one place where I can go, you know, I've been thinking about this, what do you guys think, and kick it out there. and have, you know, a doctor's doing physiology research and a guy who's been doing insurance investigations for decades, and a whole bunch of people just start picking it apart. And it felt kind of fun. So I really want to meet these guys. The guy that runs it is George Matson, and he brought Wachirayu to America in the 50s. He's one of the, you know, the grand old men.
Oh, he's an icon.
Right. He's I think the first karate book I ever picked up was by him. I didn't even recognize that at the time. It wasn't until after I met him. I was looking at my bookshelf going, hey, I do have some of his books. And anyway, I'd been doing an ungodly amount of overtime, so I actually had money to burn. I wanted to meet these guys, and just by chance, I had the week for their weekend summer camp off. So I sent an email saying, hey, I got off. I'm going to go. I'm going to be there. And next thing you know, George sends back this thing saying, good, you mind teaching some classes? That was weird because for all they knew, you know, I was a keyboard warrior. I was this 400-pound paraplegic or, you know, anything. Other than what I wrote, they knew nothing about me. And it struck me as a huge leap of faith, but George just did it, you know, casually. Yeah, whatever. They sent a limo for me at the airport, which was funny. And the temptation to try to find some bum and tell him to pretend to be me and go was just great. But I fought it off. And we just had a really great time. I learned a lot. I got to teach a lot. I just had a blast. So we went back last year, or this year.
That's I think that's phenomenal. Now, you've obviously traveled far and wide. I know that you've traveled to Canada, mm-hmm. and you know, across the United States to not only teach but further your training. When you are now at your dojo and mm-hmm. you're teaching, and I'm going to ask you this question so that you can share, you can open up your dojo for just a moment to our listeners. What are the three most important things you tell your students?
Be aware of what's going on around you. Not what you think, not what you fear, not what you expect, but what's actually happening. That means know what's going on in your body, what's going on in your opponents, or the threats, or what's going on in the dynamic all around you. Be there, deal with what's there. If we're doing a self-defense, then I want them thinking about doors, exits, running, and weapons. I don't want them trying to play to my scenario. That right there is the most important thing. Second would be when you act decisively. Don't prepare, don't think, do it. If you're trying to put a lock on, you're going to lose it. You lock it. If you're, you know, I'm going to try to hit him now, you're going to miss. You need to hit him. So first is awareness, second is initiative. And I'm not even sure I need a third thing with those two.
That's okay. I just picked three as an arbitrary number to see if there were three. Apparently, there's two, which
yeah.
You know, which are very, very solid.
Well, the temptation to make stuff up to fill lists is huge.
Yes, it is. It is. If someone wants to contact you about your writings, your seminars, what's the best way to contact Sergeant Rory Miller?
Well, Sergeant Rory Miller is a different thing. You want to contact me.
Okay.
Because I do have work email, but that would give away where I work. So, and I don't mind telling anybody, and I'm very proud of my agency. They do a good job, but policy requires me to run it by the sheriff first. And
sure.
There's no way to do that on an interview, so I leave the name out of it. My home email is Rory, R-O-R-Y, at Easy Street. EASYSTREET.com.
It's just simply Rory.
Yeah.
Rory at EasyStreet.com.
Not a lot of Rorys around, so I can usually use my first name.
The only other Rory I knew was Rory Gallagher, the blues musician. So
there you go.
Anyway, I just want to tell you that I appreciate you going over with us. We went over almost a half hour of what we usually do. Absolutely fascinating material. And again, thanks so much for spending the time with us. Sergeant Rory Miller, hand-to-hand expert, traditional jiu-jitsu instructor, police officer, thank you for your time today and going over all of this with us. This has been Martial Secrets.
Still there?
This podcast powered by Telcaster.com, the easy way to create podcasts, and it's free. Telcaster.com.